This is 4:55 on Monday, September 26th.
So to review where we are, I'm guessing that we're actually not going to get to congestion control today, that we're going to have to either do that on Wednesday or push it off until after the exam. I'm okay either way. We'll see how it goes. Today we're going to talk about round trip time estimation and flow control, and distinguish flow control from congestion control. And then on Wednesday we'll finish up whatever we can content-wise and look at a sample exam and review for the exam. So that's the plan leading up to the exam on Friday. Questions?
So the sample exam isn't available now?
It is not. It probably will be later today, I'm hoping.
Do you know if it's on one of your older sites for this class? Are there other?
There are other sample exams from the older.
Okay. And
I'll probably just pull one of those forward. The issue is that last year in particular, I had to give the exam a week earlier, so the first exam doesn't include a lot that will be included this year. So that's the one thing to pay attention to there. Okay, so that's the plan. And we'll launch into this. Any questions at this point? Everybody pretty much has got the project turned in, I think. That's good. Anything else that we need to deal with? I want to go on and talk about this then. So here's the deal. When we talked about reliable data transport, you remember that one of the issues is that in order to cope with links or channels or whatever that can drop packets, we had to institute a timeout in order to sort of trigger the sender to resend something because there wasn't anything else that would. And with TCP, this gets, the real world meets the theory when it comes to TCP. And so we have to estimate sort of on laptops and supercomputers and things that work over dial-up connections at 9600 baud or even 300 baud and networks that run at gigabits per second. We have to sort of have some general mechanism for estimating the round trip time in order to know what value to use for the timeout. That's the issue here. And it has to work across that broad spectrum of things. So what should the timeout be? Well, it's clear it needs to be longer than the round trip time. Right? There's no sense in having a timeout that goes off before you could possibly have gotten back an acknowledgement. And you don't want it to be too long, because if it's too long, then what happens is what? You lose a segment and the thing eventually just comes to a halt with nothing flowing, and then finally you get the timeout and you sort of pick things up again. So somehow you got to get into the happy medium. So the way this works with TCP is that you actually measure the amount of time that each segment takes to get acknowledged, and you factor that into a calculation that over the long term comes up with a pretty good estimate of the round trip time. So the sample round trip time here is the measurement of a single packet's round trip time, the time from when it was sent until you get back an acknowledgement for it. It's important to ignore packets that have been retransmitted. Why? They're if they've been retransmitted, it may well be necessary that they were retransmitted. But why do we want to ignore their round trip time in this calculation? How do you measure the round trip time? You record when you sent it, and you record when the ACK comes back. Okay. No. It's ambiguous whether when you get the ACK back, the ACK pertains to the original sending of the segment or the second sending of the segment. So when you, if you were to measure that, it would either be measuring something way too long or right or way too short. It could be any of those things. So the solution is to just ignore it. If you retransmitted a packet when you get an ACK back, you just ignore that one and go on. The other thing is that in the real world, the sample round trip time varies, right? Because sometimes you send something and it gets caught in a queue and it sits there for a while, and other times it goes right through, or maybe one packet goes on one on one route and another packet goes on another route. So it'll be variation. And so we actually want to smooth out the round trip, measured round trip times, by a process that I'm going to show you here in a second. So we want to average over multiple segments. Otherwise, we'd be changing our timeout clock continuously to large values and small values and so on and so forth. So the scheme that's used is this thing called an exponential weighted moving average. And all it means is that every time we get a sample round trip time, that is every time we get an acknowledgement, we update the estimated round trip time using a formula that looks like this. Where we multiply the value of the sample round trip time by typically a value that's sort of in the range of 0.8 to 0.2 or thereabouts, and multiply the previous estimate by 1 minus that. So you see that the previous estimate is the stronger influence here in this estimate, and the current sample is a smaller influence. But notice what happens. Is it on the next slide? No. It's not. So I'll just write here. Notice what happens here is that for any given sample, its influence decreases exponentially with time, right? Because once it gets to be part of estimated round trip time, then the next time it's only taken 7/8 influence, 7/8 the amount of influence it had before, and then 49/64 said, and it's a decreasing influence of any particular sample in the estimated round trip time. Does that make sense? You see how that works? No? You need to write? Well, let's look at how this goes. So I'll just use E instead of writing it out. So initially, let's say that E is equal to 1. All right. And then we get a new sample of 1.2. We'll call that S1 equals 1.2. So then the second, and this is 1/8, right? So the second value of E1 is 7/8 plus 1/8 of S1. Okay? And then The E2, actually it's easier to see, is 7/8 times 7/8 plus 1/8 of S1 plus 1/8 of S2. And E3 is 7/8 times this. Well, that's 7/8, 7/8. All right. And so what you see is that these 7/8 just keep multiplying each other. All right, so this is decreasing exponentially because we're taking higher and higher powers of 7/8, multiplying S1, multiplying S2 as time goes by. Right? So their influence just drops out of the picture. And so we're sort of looking at a window over the recent samples in which the existing average is more influential than the current sample, but still any particular sample sort of decreases out of the picture eventually. Okay?
Uh-huh.
No traffic, your round trip time decreased. Right.
Decreased.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it seems like you've maybe run into the case where you were talking about where the timeout delay might be too long.
Yes. Okay. Well, there are certainly instances in which it will be too long or too short, but still, that's fine. Okay. Because the other thing that we observe, well, I'll get to that in a second. So here's just an example of how this works. Suppose the dark purple are the samples, and the light purple are the moving average. Okay, so you get the sense of how the dark purple can be shooting all around. It has a small influence on the light purple even though it's very large. Does make it go up, but it doesn't make it go up anywhere near that amount. Okay.
How many measurements does it take before the estimated return or round trip time is reliable?
Oh, that's a good question, but I don't know that I have a good answer.
Would you generally set the starting value of the estimated trip at zero, or would you overshoot it and then so that you aren't doing extra?
Right. You would tend to want to overshoot it. Okay. I would think that within 3 or 4, you would be doing pretty good, unless it's really.
Yeah.
Really bouncy. And we're going to see how we deal with the bounciness here in a second. Yeah, Ryan.
Does it do that for every host that tries to contact?
Does this for each TCP stream separately? Each TCP stream is done separately. Oops. All right. So the other thing that is going on here is that they're bouncing around, you saw. And the bouncier they are, the less reliable the estimated round trip time is. And so to avoid having the thing time out when you get into one of those big ones, right, you want to use the estimated round trip time plus some safety margin. You don't want it to be too big, because then you'll be sort of late with your timeouts, and that's not good. But you don't want it to be too small, because then if it's really bouncy, you'll be timing out when you shouldn't be. So to handle that, they actually estimate not only the estimated round trip time, but also the deviation from the round trip time, sort of in a statistical sense. And it uses a similar calculation. It says the deviation is an exponential weighted moving average of the previous deviation and the deviation for this current sample. And so the old ones again sort of disappear, and the new ones don't have too much individual effect, but if it changes significantly sort of in over three or four samples, then it will adjust that. So the timeout then is chosen to be the estimated round trip time, which is what you'd, you know, if it were constant, that's what you'd really like it to be, plus four times the deviation, and probably plus a constant in case the deviation is too close to zero. But okay? You look bothered.
Yeah, I don't want to do this on a test. But it's probably going to happen.
Probably. It's really, you know, it's simple math.
Sure, will only have us do it for like 8 iterations.
Oh, 10 at least. Okay. Well, but the important thing is seeing the idea of the weighted average to make it old things go away, and to see that the timeout you choose has to be sort of cognizant of both the particular round trip time of this TCP stream and its deviation.
Is that actually updated every single time you calculate a new one, or does it update it every so often?
It calculates the retransmission time and the deviation with every sample, but it only changes the timeout interval when it needs to establish a new timeout.
Okay.
So if there's already a timeout running, it's not going to change it for that one. Now, when things are working normally, however, every received sample is going to correspond to actually updating the timer, because in the normal case, the timer is associated with the oldest unACT data, and the normal case is that when you get an ACK, it updates that, if there haven't been losses. Okay. So, coming back to TCP reliable data, we're on top of an unreliable service. We've seen how we do pipelining, which is we send multiple things, multiple segments that are unACT. We get cumulative ACKs. We covered that last time. That is, when we get an ACK, it means we received everything up to that point. We use a single transmission timer for the oldest unACT data. And now let's look at how we handle retransmission. So the cool thing is that the reality of TCP led people to figure out ways to do additional retransmissions without waiting for timeouts. That's kind of a key insight that the designers had, and it pertains to what happens when you get duplicate acknowledgments. We'll think about what that means. Okay, so here's how it goes. When we're trying to send some data that we receive from the application, we create a segment, we give it a sequence number. Remember, the sequence number is what? It's the position of the first byte of that segment in the overall stream. We start a timer. We start a timer if we send the thing. And we set the timeout for that timer to be the timeout interval as calculated previously. when a timeout occurs, we retransmit the segment that caused the timeout. Remember, that's always going to be the oldest one, the oldest unacknowledged one. And we restart the timer because we think, well, that one should get there in the amount of time that we expect it to. When we get an acknowledgement, if it acknowledges previously unacted data, that's fine. We just move the point of unacknowledgement and restart the timer. Okay, because now the position where it's unacknowledged has changed, and so the thing that we're waiting for has to be changed to represent the amount of time we expect that to take. And that has to be done a little bit cleverly because a certain amount of time has gone by for that segment already. Right? It's already been sent. We got an acknowledgement for stuff that came before it. That took a certain amount of time, so we have to adjust the actual timeout as we set it. But that's all clear. All right. That's good. Do I want to talk about this? This just says in code what the previous thing said in... Yeah, the one thing that's a little misleading here is... The invariant for send base is that send base minus one is the last acknowledged byte of the stream. That means that send base itself is the first unacknowledged. And there's different ways of saying the same thing. This is equal to the send base is the first unacknowledged byte. Okay? And that means that send base is actually set to the value that you got in the acknowledgement packet. Because remember, the acknowledgement packet is the first, it is the first thing that the receiver is still expecting. Okay? So that's what this code says here. This example is pertaining specifically to this code here. Send base minus 1 is 71. That means that the previous acknowledgement value was 72. Now we see a value of 73. It's greater than the previously acknowledged previous acknowledgement value, so we set send base to be that. All right, so that's what happened. And if there are not acknowledgements... So just more of these diagrams. What happens when you lose an acknowledgement after the timeout? You resend the previous segment. And eventually you get back an acknowledgement for that. If we're cranking along, segment 92 with 8 bytes, segment 100 with 20 bytes, we ACK 100, we ACK 120. If the timeout occurs, we resend 92 and hopefully get back an acknowledgement of 120, right? Because the receiver already had up to 120. When it gets this one, it says, well, I already had that, so I'm going to tell you, okay, go on from there. The other thing that can happen, of course, is that the timeout interval is long enough that you actually get the ACK for 120 before it occurs. Everything's happy. Nobody cares. So lost ACKs can be completely benign. So how do you generate the rules for TCP ACK generation? Somebody asked me about this after class. what happens, how can you avoid sending so many ACKs? And TCP tries to do that. The rule is, when you get the segment that you're expecting, and you've already acknowledged everything up to that point, you just chill for a half second, up to a half second, and say, you know, it's in all likelihood I'm going to get another segment here shortly, so I'll just see if that happens. So you delay the ACK for up to 500 milliseconds, and if 500 milliseconds go by, then you ACK it. So now notice this means that TCP has a timer for receiving as well as for sending. That's kind of different. It's just to avoid sending so many ACKs. If you get an in-order segment, that means it's the one you're expecting, and you already have an ACK pending, then you send an ACK. And you send an ACK for both of them. It's just one single number, and that's good. If you get an out-of-order segment with a higher sequence number than you're expecting, well, that's that's an actually interesting case. That means that that there's a gap, right? That you've missed something. And the cool thing is that TCP immediately sends an ACK up to the beginning of the gap. Now that seems a little weird, but we're going to see how that gets used here in a second. And when you get a segment that fills in a gap, you can send an ACK that moves ahead the point that you're expecting. So those are all the different behaviors for the receiver with respect to ACKs. And then the sender takes advantage of that duplicate ACK behavior by the receiver to do this cool thing called fast retransmit. So let's look again. I'm going to draw a picture. So here's the sender, here's the receiver, here's the link between them. This is sort of like that picture that had the picture of the United States behind it with a long line and lots of packets on it. And lots of ACKs going back. And now let's think about what happens when, say, this packet is lost. Okay, so you just got to make a motion picture in your head and see these things as flowing, right, around here. And so this one is lost. That means the receiver sees a gap, right? But it gets this one next, and it says, oh, there's a gap. Starts counting. I've seen one segment that I'm not happy with. What do? I ACK this one. All right, so I put an ACK for this one on the wire. Then I see this one. Still got a gap. I put an ACK for that one on the wire. I put an ACK for this one on the wire again.
So it would be multiple duplicate ACKs.
So we're getting duplicate ACKs as these later segments arrive. And the fast retransmit thing says, when I get three of those, I resend the missing packet. So notice what this has done. This has essentially shortened the retransmit time from the estimated round trip time plus four standard deviations to the retransmit to the actual round trip time plus three packet times. Okay? So that's what's cool, right? Because now you haven't had to wait for the timeout, which was only a guess. You've actually managed to put it on just about as soon as you possibly could. As soon as you possibly could be would be when getting the first duplicate back. But why wouldn't you want to do that?
In case the packet arrives just a little bit later.
Right. In case that in fact what happened was that this one went over some other route that made it get there just a little bit later. Okay, so we'd like not to have to do that. So again, real world consequences of reliable data transport. Reliable data transport meets the real world. So here's a picture of this. I don't know. Sometimes I see it better when I look at it in that sort of rotating picture of packets instead of this one. But this is the same idea.
Wouldn't the timeout start when the file is sent? Not when it receives its first ACK?
Well, there was a timeout that was started here.
Oh, okay.
Okay. It's not displayed. We restart it. We start the one for this segment when we receive this ACK.
Okay.
Okay, so we didn't show that one because the first one wasn't interesting. Yeah.
Does the resend start at the end of the last packet or at the reception of the next ACK?
Does the resend start?
So the resend from host A starts, according to the diagram, at the end of the fifth packet.
It starts at the end of the receipt of the third duplicate ACK. See, these ACKs are all the same. They all say that can have the same content.
Okay.
Because this one is missing, right? So these three are.
But they're different sequences, right?
These are different packets. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, those are all different.
Right, so wouldn't host A at the reception of the third ACK go, I didn't get ACK 2?
That's what he says. I didn't get ACK 2, so he resends this segment.
Right, but wouldn't he start resending the second segment at the reception of the third ACK rather than the fifth ACK?
This is the fourth ACK. 1, 2, 3, 4. And it's the third duplicate ACK. Okay, which makes it the fourth ACK. Yeah. off by one errors.
Well, I just felt like the resend would have started two up, but I mean maybe it's just based on timeouts and stuff.
You think it should start here?
Well, I would have thought that it would have gone, hey, I didn't get an ACK for the second packet.
Well, that's what I said. The reason it waits for three of them is in the case that maybe this packet was actually just delayed a little bit. And so to avoid adding extra work to the network, it's just being a little bit conservative.
Oh, okay.
Okay? That's all. Like I said, its theory meets the real world. You have to pick a number. Is it 3, 2, 1, 5? Duplicate acts, you get to choose, and they chose 3 as being the one that works best in the real world. Yeah, Ryan?
The data in the segments after the long segment, is it those three segments, the data that's actually being translated further is different than the original lost, correct? Those are different.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is 1, 2, 3, 4. 5 different packets. Different contents. Different payloads, different sequence numbers, all that stuff. But the ACKs are, well, let me put them in square boxes to show.
Would they be 2? They didn't receive 2?
Yeah, you're right.
I thought that'd be one because they don't want to acknowledge that two existed.
Remember that the acknowledgments are the first thing you didn't get, rather than the first thing than the last thing you did. just to confuse the poor student. Yeah. Okay. So that's fast retransmit. And there's the algorithm. Okay, flow control. So here's the issue with flow control. You've got a certain amount of space in the receiver for buffering stuff. And buffering bytes. And the application process that's consuming that data runs at its own speed, whatever that is. And so if this application process is able to consume data slower than the sender is able to send it, we run the risk of filling up the available buffer space in the receiver. And if we fill up the available buffer space, then we're going to end up having to throw away data, and that's wasted work on the network, and we don't want to do that, wasting resources on the network. So the trick of flow control is to just tell the sender to slow down when you need to, when the receiver is going slower than the sender. And so to do that, what happens is the receiver, and you'll if you look back at the notes about the TCP segment header, you'll see that there's a field in there for something called the receive window. And basically what the receive window is how many more bytes is the receiver willing to take into its buffer than it already has.
This is
TCP. Yeah.
Right, but only this certain connection, not like any connection that host has.
It's as far as the receiver is concerned, it's allowed to calculate this any way it wants to. Could be averaged over or summed over everything, or you know, whatever it wants to do. It's what?
Or each connection might have its own buffer depending on how you
implement. Yeah, each one might have its own buffer. The important thing is that the receiver says with each acknowledgement that it sends, that is with each segment that it sends back to the sender, it says, how much space am I willing to let you have now? The sender is supposed to look at that number and say, well, how much unacknowledged data have I got on the wire already? And will what I'm about to send fit too? And if it won't, it's supposed to not send it. And so what happens is that so this starts to fill up eventually, right, and the sender has already got this much stuff on the wire. What's going to happen is that as additional packets come in here, they're going to get acknowledged, and the receiver will slowly reflect smaller and smaller amounts of space until the application takes some data out of here, and then it can start saying, I have more space. And the sender can start sending again. All right. So the one important thing to get about this discussion of flow control is that flow control is about the relationship of space between what the receiver has available and what the sender has sent but is not yet acknowledged. How far ahead of the receiver does the of the receiving application process essentially, is the sender allowed to get? So that's one way that you got to slow down the senders. The other way is for congestion control. And we're going to talk about that not this time, but next time. Congestion control, I think I've said it before, but I'll say it again, is related to the relationship between the sender and the rate at which the sender is sending and the resources in the network, not the receiver, in the network. Because congestion is associated with too many people trying to use the network at once. Okay, one last thing for today. How do we get a TCP connection started? It begins with, and we've sort of alluded to this when we talked about socket programming, it begins with what's called a three-way handshake between the client and the server. So remember, the client starts with a connection, with a connect operation, which causes the client TCP implementation to send a segment to the server that has that SYN bit set. If you look back again at the description of the TCP segment header, one of those bit fields is SYN, SYN, synchronize. So we set that bit, and we set an initial sequence number. So TCP actually doesn't always start with sequence number 0. It starts at an arbitrary point and just works from there around the 32-bit space. Doesn't matter. It's just, and it has some useful security implications to do it that way, so that's why they do it. So you start with an arbitrary sequence number, and everybody knows that's what you started with, and everything just works, so that's not too much. So the initial SYN doesn't have any data in it. The server to which you are connecting, which accepts the connection, replies with a packet in which both the SYN bit and the ACK bit are set. And actually supplies its own initial sequence number as well, and acknowledges the SYN packet from the other side. And finally, the client receives this SYN packet. It's at that point that the connection is established. And when the client gets that, it acknowledges it and sends the first bit of the data, or not. It's sort of up to it. In the usual way, you can always send an ACK whether you have data to send in that direction or not. Okay? So that's the three-way handshake for TCP connection setup.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. Does the server return a sequence number that's arbitrary compared to the client?
Again, it has some minor security benefits.
Well, do we use that sequence number, or do we use the one we
supply? Oh, good question. So the sequence number from the client to the server is used for data going in that direction. The sequence number from the server to the client is for data going in that direction.
Okay. I was just
confused. Yeah. Oh no, it's easy to be confused about this stuff because there's a lot going on in this.
So those are arbitrary starting points.
Yeah.
The rest of the connection will use those.
We'll just proceed from that point forward. Yeah. So pictorially, how do you close a connection? You use the fin bit, standing for finish, I guess. So one side sends a fin, the other side acknowledges it, sometime later sends its fin, sometime later sends an ACK, and then there's a time out period because you have to worry about what happens if these ACKs are lost. And that's all way too complicated to get into as in an introduction.
So is it possible to have a client whose connection is closed but the server's still throwing stuff at it?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the I thought when you send, or because you aren't receiving any acts whatsoever, it just closed the connection.
You aren't receiving any acts.
Because the client, so server, so the client sends a fin. And the server acknowledges it, but then still is sending packets.
It can keep sending. That's a beast known as a half open connection.
Well, then wouldn't the client not send any acknowledgments for?
No, the client is still expected to keep acknowledging.
Okay.
Right, because it hasn't seen the fin yet from the server.
Okay.
So that half open state can persist sort of arbitrarily long. It's not a very nice state, but it
can. Half open is before the client receives the fin.
It's before the client receives the fin, yeah.
What happens if the last act is lost, though, then?
Well, that's what this time wait is all about. Right, to make sure that you can send another acknowledgement, and yeah, big mess. If you ever have to implement TCP for yourself, you have to sort of get into that. But usually for users of TCP, this is not very interesting. Period. So half open connections. Oh, the other thing that can happen here is that suppose the client and the server both send a fin before either of them has acknowledged it. That gets weird too, right? So the server sent. This
so
can happen.
Sent together, like both bits on. Like I acknowledge your fin.
Yeah, it's just a little trickier. Yeah, it works. You just have to design for it.
Those are two separate packets, though, the way they're drawing it now, even though you could send it as one packet?
You could send a FinAC here.
Right.
Yeah, if the server was really ready to close as well, he could send a FinAC. Although, you know, it's... sort of very much timing dependent on the interactions with the client, with the application code, as to whether that would actually ever happen or not. Yeah.
So he's looking at this and it says it has the time wait starting from the server's bin, and then it says entered time wait will respond with ACTS received bins. It's implying that you can get multiple.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, suppose. This guy has set a fin. He's going to have a timeout running as well.
Okay.
And then after a while, you know, you can reach a state where maybe this guy still hasn't received an ACK for his fin, but this guy is going to just go away and
okay.
Stop responding entirely. No, yeah, no. The only thing that will happen is during this interval, if he gets more fins, he'll send ACK again. And after this interval, if he gets fins, he won't. Oh, well, then bad things can potentially happen, but that's why you choose those to be fairly long intervals. So here are state machines representing how things go. Fine. Next time we'll do congestion control.